May it please the court, my name is Tim Beyer, registration number 12168, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Roger Parker. I hope to reserve 2 or 3 minutes of my time for what we'll see how it goes. The trial court found that Tresinda knew the $4.50 dispute was alive in December of 2010 when Tresinda and Parker entered into the Second Amendment, and that they agreed to defer that dispute and limit the Second Amendment to the act of substituting collateral. Those express findings, in the words of the district court, quote, conclusively defeat any suggestion that the parties intended to extinguish Tresinda's obligations or to release Tresinda from his prior breach, end quote. And therefore, those findings negate both waiver and estoppel and require reversal under any standard of appellate review. Parker borrowed $7.5 million and has never disputed his obligation to repay it. But when he tried to sell the collateral to repay more than $5.6 million of that debt, Tresinda breached the pledge agreement and refused to allow the sale because of its concerns that it might be engaged in an insider trading based on its possession of material, negative, non-public information about Delta Petroleum. This is not a case of a borrower not wanting to pay back a loan. It is a case of a lender preventing the borrower from paying back the loan because of the lender's concerns over its own possible insider trading. Now, Tresinda breached the pledge agreement in September of 2009. That was found by the court and has not been appealed by Tresinda. Parker told Tresinda on the day of the breach that Tresinda's refusal to allow the sale was wrong, that under the contract he had the right to sell. That's in finding of fact number 31. And his lawyer had the same conversation with Tresinda's lawyer on the same day. That's finding of fact number 29. By the time Tresinda allowed Parker to sell 11 days later on September 28th, the share price had dropped by more than 50% because of the public announcement of negative information about the company. And for the next 15 months, Parker and Tresinda had no reason to have any contact with each other, so they never discussed the $4.50 dispute again. Parker chose to hold the stock in the hopes that its price would increase, just as Tresinda did. The note, the $7.5 million note, was not due for another 20 months, so Parker had the right and the ability to wait and hope that the price would go up. And had it increased to $4.50 or above, of course, he would have had no reason to assert a claim against Tresinda for refusing to allow him to sell at $4.50 back in September of 2009. They both held their stock for this entire 15 months. In fact, Tresinda never sold a share of Delta stock and lost all of their $800 million investment when Delta filed for bankruptcy. But the first occasion after the breach where Parker had a reason to sell was in late 2010 when he needed to sell for tax reasons. So he again demanded to sell, and this time Tresinda agreed, but only on the condition that Parker do two things, neither of which the pledge agreement required him to do. One was to pay $1 million in cash, and the other was to substitute collateral for a completely unrelated company called Recovery Energy. Both parties benefited from this arrangement, so they agreed and entered into the Second Amendment to accomplish the payment and the substitution of collateral.
Counsel, wouldn't that Second Amendment have been a perfect opportunity for your client to have reserved its rights vis-a-vis the, you know, what it believed to be the original breach to specifically addressing? We're not in any way giving up our right to proceed on that breach.
It would have been an opportunity to do that, except for the fact that the court found, this is not a fact that I'm saying ought to have been found, the court specifically found that both parties knew that dispute was extant and agreed to put it off until the following after the holidays. Keep in mind that this transaction is occurring in mid-December of 2010. Parker has to sell his shares in order to get the tax loss by the end of the year. The record was undisputed that Tresinda's office is closed, I think somewhere around the 21st or so of December for the rest of the year. So they didn't have much time to get the substitution of collateral and the sale of the stock done by the end of the year. So the district court found that they agreed to put off that issue, Judge Fox, and to deal with it after the first of the year. And they did. And when they failed to agree, Parker sued. And he did it 2.5 years before the expiration of the statute of limitations.
But didn't the court also find, the court found that Parker, when he executed the authorization letter to the Bank of America, in which he authorized the sale of the stock at $4.50 per share, and because he waited 15 months, that he had waived his right to make these claims against Tresenda?
I don't think so. I don't think the court did include the Bank of America letter as a basis for waiver. It said in a parenthetical, it made the observation that he had done that, but the district court was saying, was observing that as evidence that would tend to contradict Parker's view of what the $4.50 provision meant. It said it was inconsistent with his view, but the court already decided, or went on to decide, nonetheless, that Parker's view was correct and that Tresenda was in breach. So, furthermore, the Bank of America letter isn't really relevant to that issue anyway. Even if the court had said it based its waiver decision on that, which it didn't, it's not relevant because that's not an agreement between Parker and Tresenda. Tresenda wasn't a party to that. That was what Parker called a sell order that he put into Bank of America, saying, please, if that happens, please sell my stock. But the testimony in the record was that that was not intended by Tresenda, who gave the language to Bank of America, to in any way affect the agreement, the pledge agreement between Parker and Tresenda. So it has nothing to do with the determination of whether Parker waived his right. The trial court expressly said, quote, both Taylor and Parker testified that they were aware of the party's dispute regarding the $4.50 provision when they negotiated and entered into the Second Amendment, and they did not intend the Second Amendment to have any effect on that dispute. Now, with that finding, essential elements of waiver and estoppel are negated as a matter of law, and there are no facts that relate to those that are in dispute. And so these are matters of law to be determined by this court. The first issue is the waiver issue. And both sides cite the Intel case for setting forth the standard under California law, which is the conduct which is so inconsistent with the intent to enforce the right as to induce a reasonable belief that such right has been relinquished. And the trial court finding that Tresenda knew that the dispute was extant and its agreement to put that off until after the first of the year negates that definition of waiver. The court basically is relying on inaction. What it said in its discussion of waiver, Judge Hawthorne, was that that Parker didn't do anything for that period of 15 months. And that's the basis on which the court below found that there was a waiver. But for inaction to constitute a waiver, it must be so fundamentally inconsistent with the intent to preserve one's rights that the only rational conclusion is that one intended to relinquish his rights. There must be no other reasonable explanation for the inaction other than the intent to relinquish the right. That's from the central bank case that we cited. And the waiver is to be effected only in exceptional circumstances. That was the Summing case from the Ninth Circuit. As we do not want people to be found to have waived important rights without it being very clear that they intended to do so. And here, as I've said, the trial court's finding that they both knew the rights and both agreed to defer them is the antithesis of a relinquishment of a right. And keep in mind that it's not like Parker never asserted his position or that Tresenda was wrong in their refusal to allow him to sell. It happened twice on the day of the breach. The district court's waiver argument, or waiver finding conclusion, was on the basis of subsequent non-raising of that issue. And furthermore, the pledge agreement says that there is no limit on his time to sell. The pledge agreement said at any time. So under their contract, Parker had the right to sell or not sell, to make the decision in his discretion whether to sell at a terribly low price and yield a small amount to pay back only a portion of his loan, or to wait, as Tresenda did too, in the hopes that the price would go up and that he'd be able to pay back more of the loan when he sold the collateral. That was his right, not only legally, because he had no duty to sell stock at any particular time, but also under the express terms of the contract. Now, the court also relied on estoppel. And the problem with the estoppel finding is that two of the essential elements of estoppel are negated by that specific finding of the court that they both knew that the issue was still there and they both agreed to defer. The first is that the third element of estoppel under the Marriage of Thompson case from California is that Tresidda had to have been ignorant of Parker's claim. And the courts expressly found they were not ignorant of the claim. They knew that it was a lie. And the second issue is detrimental reliance. And here, the trial court's finding negates that element as well. Tresidda merely did what it was required to do per the contract, according to the court's ruling on the fact that they breached the $4.50 requirement. They let Parker sell and they received the proceeds. It can't be detrimental reliance to perform an act that you have a contractual obligation to do. Or put another way, it isn't detrimental reliance not to breach a contract. Further, the court's findings were that the reliance, that there was no detriment. Tresidda got two benefits that they weren't otherwise intended to get under the agreement. One, they got cash. It's the only cash they ever got for a sale of Delta stock, that $1 million. That was to their benefit. And secondly, they got substitute collateral that they had no entitlement to under the agreement whatsoever. So a conclusion of law that is directly foreclosed by specific findings of facts cannot be sustained. I'll reserve a couple minutes for rebuttal unless the court has questions on that.
Thank you.
It pleases the court and counsel. I'm Jim Lyons, registration number 882. The entire appeal here that's been brought by Mr. Parker is predicated on a false legal premise. And that is that this case and this court should review this de novo and ignore the findings of the trial court, which were made on a disputed record. First of all, the trial court denied summary judgment, specifically finding that there were issues of disputed fact, both as to credibility and as to ambiguity with regard to the underlying contract. Secondly, if you read the court order on its merits, which is at the electronically filed record 1381 to 1400, the entire order, the entire decision of the court, turns on the contested testimony of three key witnesses from Tresidda, Mr. Sabell, Mr. Christensen, and Mr. Taylor, and the three key witnesses put forward by Mr. Parker himself and his two lawyers, Mr. Brownstein and Mr. Denby. That conflicting testimony was considered by Judge McGahee in order to reach his conclusions. First, that there was a breach of the underlying contract by my client, but that breach was waived, and that the equitable defenses, waiver estoppel, and failure to mitigate damages all barred his recovery. The suggestion under California law, the Cordillera case cited by Mr. Parker, that the standard of review here is de novo, is readily distinguishable. Cordillera was a case that went to the California Court of Appeals after it was decided on summary judgment. By definition, there were no issues of material fact, or the case would have gone to trial. So what are the standards here? We submit the standards are that findings of fact are not to be set aside unless they're clearly erroneous. That's the Weisinger case of this court. That there must be no support in the record. That's the Schuler case of this court. That the facts are to be considered in a light most favorable to the prevailing party. That's the In re State of Hines case of this court. And last but not least, because equity is involved here, the abuse of discretion standard must be applied. We submit that when all those standards are considered, the conclusions of the trial court on the equitable defenses must be upheld. Any one of those defenses, by the way, any one of those defenses being upheld requires this court to affirm below. Now, Mr. Byer made reference to some findings that Judge McGahee made in rejecting our defense of novation. In December of 2010, when that transaction occurred, when the promissory note was extended and didn't have to be, when shares were released and didn't have to be by my client, new collateral was accepted, which didn't have to be, and a payment of $1 million on a $7.5 million promissory note was accepted. All of that, we argued, was a novation. Judge McGahee said, no, it's not a novation. It's not a new contract. Which means the old contract from September of 2009, which he found to be in breach and waived, is still in effect. For 15 months, nothing is done by Mr. Parker. My client materially changes its position in December of 2010. Detrimental reliance to my client then occurs. Estoppel is established in addition to the same facts, which established the underlying waiver.
What was the detrimental reliance by your client in December 2010?
We extended the promissory note.
What was the change of position?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what we did. And we didn't have to do anything. As Mr. Byer says, we weren't required to do anything, either under the pledge agreement or the note. One other point I would make is this, and we made this point in our brief, I hope. In September, when the initial demand was made to release the shares, 10th of 17th, and rejected. Nothing was done for 15 months thereafter, but that's not the end of the story in September. On September 28th, Mr. Christensen from Tresenda tells Mr. Brownstein, representing Mr. Parker, you can now sell the shares whenever you deem it to be appropriate. The record will reflect what the price of those shares was at the time, and I think it was somewhere above $2.70 a share. Ultimately, when the shares are sold, by the way, they're sold for 76 cents. So, at least as of September, Mr. Parker had the opportunity to sell his shares.
But doesn't that issue go potentially to mitigation of damages as opposed to whether or not the affirmative defenses your client asserted apply?
Correct, it does, Your Honor. And he failed to mitigate, and he could have done so. As early as September, of 2009. But no mitigation, if any at all, takes place until at least December, when shares are sold, some payment is made, and the note is extended.
I'm having trouble finding detrimental reliance when both sides had very, very competent counsel advising them. So, you know, I can see a situation where, you know, there's strategic reasons why your client might want the $1 million up front and additional collateral. But it's hard for me to see detrimental reliance, again, when both sides have excellent counsel. How do you respond to that?
Counsel or not, the fact is detrimental reliance requires you to do something to your detriment you are not otherwise legally required to do. And that's what we did in December of 2010. I don't think the question of counsel, competent or otherwise, and both sides clearly did have counsel, enters into the equation here. At least it didn't for the trial court and any findings that the trial court made.
I think in response to my question, you said that your client's detrimental reliance was based upon its extension of the promissory note in December of 2010. Is that the detrimental reliance that you are relying on?
It's part of it.
Okay, what's the rest of it?
We didn't have to release. We released shares of Delta Petroleum, where my client still had a significant interest and presumably had some knowledge of the value of the shares. For shares, we didn't know anything about this company called Recovery Energy. We didn't have to do that.
I guess I'm confused, but I think that Judge McGahee had ruled that Tresenda did have an obligation to release those Delta Petroleum shares, have an obligation to allow Parker to sell them.
That's true. The totality of what happened in December constitutes the inaction for 15 months, frankly, from September of 2009 until December of 2010, is what J.J. McGahee found, on a disputed record, by the way, to be inaction, to be silenced when he had a duty to speak. That's the Shiloh case. And action taken by my client, which it did not have to take at that time. It just did not have to take. In the meantime, nothing had happened in the intervening period of time. My client was put on no notice by Mr. Parker or his lawyers, competent as they are, that they had a claim. There was no suit filed until after we had accommodated and then filed suit against us 5 weeks later.
I didn't see any, excuse me.
If the parties knew that the $4.50 issue was still alive, why was there a duty to say something further?
Well, the mere passage of time can constitute waiver, Your Honor. And if Mr. Parker wanted to preserve his position or mitigate his damages, he had to do something. He just couldn't sit on his rights, for whatever rights he thought he had, for 15 months, which is precisely what he did.
Why couldn't he, if the statute of limitations was 3 years in Colorado, 4 years in California? Why did he have to do anything?
Because waiver and other equitable defenses, laches, for example, can always attach before the statute of limitations runs. If not, the statute of limitations or the equitable doctrines don't mean anything. So if you're talking about issues or claims in equity, either equitable claims or equitable defenses, then you have to consider waiver, estoppel, and laches separate and apart from the statute of limitations.
I
think that's the law in both Colorado and California.
I guess I'm in the same frame of mind as Judge Fox is, perhaps. I can see that your client took steps that it didn't have to take, but I'm having a difficult time seeing how that was detrimental to them when they received $1 million cash and they received substitute collateral, which they weren't entitled to receive except by this new amendment to the pledge agreement. So what is the detriment that they...
So let's assume this, Your Honor. Let's assume they told us in December, we're going to sue you because we believe the underlying contract's in breach. I think it's reasonable to assume my client would have said, fine, we're doing nothing, sue us. Instead, he didn't tell us that. We believe he had a legal duty to speak, and we renewed his promissory note to the following May. He waited 5 weeks and then sued us so he could avoid that obligation, which at that point is at about $5 million before interest and attorney's fees. So we detrimentally relied, if nothing else, on his silence. And we think that makes out, as Judge McGahee found, waiver, estoppel, and failure to mitigate damages.
Well, as far as failure to mitigate damages, I think you mentioned just now that the stock did sell for 76 cents.
I think that's in the record, yes.
And did Parker apply that amount to the note?
I don't believe so. I believe the note when he, the suit we filed to enforce the note, the counterclaim, if you will, to enforce the note, was for the principal balance less than $1 million we received, plus prejudgment interest, post-judgment interest, and attorney's fees.
I'm having a little bit of a problem with Judge McKay's finding that Parker was barred from any recovery at all for failure to mitigate damages, rather than figuring out what amount he unreasonably failed to mitigate.
Well, there was no evidence at trial that he made any effort to mitigate in any way, complete or partial. I mean, go back to September 28th, 2009, when he is told, his lawyer is told by Mr. Christensen, you can sell the shares whenever you want. Stock then is roughly $2.70-some a share. He does nothing. So he had his opportunity then to partially mitigate if he chose. He didn't choose to mitigate at all, excuse me, completely or partially.
When did it become unreasonable for him not to sell the stock?
I would argue on September 28th. Now he's told he can sell the stock. The only objection Tresinda had, other than the disagreement on the underlying contract, of course, was that Tresinda felt because it was in possession of non-material public information as a public company, it didn't want to be the seller of the shares and to create a securities problem for itself.
aren't we judging the unreasonableness by hindsight, though? I mean, let's say if he'd sold the stocks in September and then they had gone way up, then the decision to sell would be unreasonable.
Well, except for this, Your Honor. Mr. Parker was the founder of this company. He was the chairman and CEO at one point. He had a substantial ownership. If anybody knew the value of this company and its prospects, it was Roger Parker. My client owned a significant share, to be sure, but my client was not in control of this company, didn't found it, was not the president and CEO, and knew what it knew, of course. But Mr. Parker was in a unique position here, and it's, I think, important to keep that in mind. I see my time is up, unless the court has any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lyons. And Mr. Beyer, looks like you have about 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Since my brain works on the theory of privacy, I'm going to go in reverse order and start at the end of Mr. Lyons' argument. First, he says that Mr. Parker was in a unique position. What Mr. Lyons seems to have forgotten is that Mr. Parker had been out of Delta Petroleum for almost 2 years at this point, and according to a specific finding of the court, had no inside information about the ongoings of the operations of Delta Petroleum. So he did not have any unique position at all. In fact, Tresinda, as chairman, Dan Taylor, its officer, as chairman of Delta, was the person in a unique position to know, not Mr. Parker. Mr. Lyons says it was unreasonable as of September 28th, when they finally took the handcuffs off Mr. Parker. It was at that time unreasonable for him not to have sold his stock. But Tresinda testified, Mr. Taylor testified, that it was not unreasonable to hold the stock for that entire period, just as he, on behalf of Tresinda, had done. There is no duty to sell. As Your Honor points out, we would be having exactly the opposite argument had the stock gone in the other direction. And keep in mind that Mr. Parker knew that if the stock price ever did go back up to $4.50, where it had been, that he would have no claim. He would be able to sell it for $4.50, and there'd be no issue. He'd get all the money, use it to pay down the loan, and there wouldn't be anything to be suing about. Now, in terms of detrimental reliance, Mr. Lyons, I think maybe misstated something, but the Second Amendment did not extend the note. And it's in the record, you can look at it, but it did not extend the note. The only thing the Second Amendment did in the testimony was that the only purpose of it was to account for the payment of cash and the substitution collateral. It did not extend the note. Tresinda did nothing to its detriment. In fact, Tresinda was the one that demanded that there be a Second Amendment to document this transaction. Exhibit N in the trial court, which is in the record, and page 458 of the testimony from Mr. Taylor confirmed that it was a letter that Tresinda sent to Parker that demanded that there be a Second Amendment. This document was not something that Parker foisted on Tresinda. Exactly the opposite is true. Now, with respect to the standard review, and both in the brief and argument, Tresinda spends a lot of time focused on the standard of review. And they want to focus on, they want to ignore the factual findings of the court and focus on underlying facts that were hotly disputed. But our reliance is on the findings that the court made based on all of those disputed facts. We agree with those findings of fact. Tresinda did not appeal them, and so they are conclusive at this point. Under any standard of review, we think that these findings are contrary to, that these conclusions are contrary to the findings and cannot be sustained. But the reason why it's de novo review is simple. There are no facts that are in dispute. Parker doesn't dispute that he didn't sell the shares before December of 2010. He doesn't dispute that he didn't reassert his position between September of 2009 and December of 2010. Tresinda hasn't cross-appealed, so they haven't challenged the findings of fact, and there's no dispute that the Second Amendment provided two benefits and no detriments to Tresinda. So there are no facts that are in dispute. There's a legal conclusion based on findings. They conflict with each other, and they can't be sustained.
Thank you, Mr. Beyer. And thank you, Mr. Lyons. We appreciate your very helpful arguments. And the matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much, and counsel, excuse.